Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo, Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, August 29th, 2011. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And please note that our shows will also be archived on DrSaputo.com.
Today you're going to be listening to Vicky's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour, and we've got another great show for you today that will include, are there solutions that can solve today's healthcare system problems?
And a novel way to control the most common hospital-acquired infections.
Can spices actually prevent liver disease, liver cancer?
And can drawing blood for lab tests have a downside? And much more. Plus, if you want to join in our conversations and have questions about our topics, give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. The healthcare system, the way it is designed today, is pretty expensive, and it has serious safety limitations, and it's not effective in curing the epidemics of chronic diseases. Now a study comes out that was done in Canada that concluded that it would be very difficult to remedy these situations except perhaps by cutting costs through bulk spending of drugs and services.
Oh, listen, Vicky, there's no way to solve this problem the way they're going about it. You've got a system that doesn't work. Let's get it in our heads. It doesn't work. It doesn't work financially. We can't keep up with the skyrocketing health care costs that there are. It doesn't work because it doesn't solve the epidemic of chronic diseases. 50% of us still have a disease that's chronic in this country. And the safety issues are huge. We're losing about a million people a year that are dying from complications of what we do in healthcare. That's a huge number. We need to find a system that's different, that's based on different premises. We depend on getting sick. Getting sick is not the great way to work a healthcare system.
It's a sick care system instead of a healthcare system.
Exactly. So we need to do something to prevent disease, to have wellness, to enjoy yourselves, to have quality of life, to have values that make some kind of sense. So we can have communities that live together and support one another.
You know, during our elections, there was a lot of talk about universal health care, and Canada has universal health care, but it's sounding like it's not working so well for them.
Well,
and how does their attitude affect us with our healthcare system?
Well, how can their system work? Because what they've done is they've simply modified what they do by cutting costs by having universal health care. And that's fine. It does cut costs, but they're still spending 10% of the gross national product, as are most countries in the world. We spend 18% of the gross national product, and yet we're still ranked 37th in the world in overall quality of health care. And a lot of that is because of lack of accessibility and disparities in health care. That has to change. Until we get that through our thick skulls, that it has to change to become a wellness-oriented system where we take care of ourselves and we figure that lifestyle is the best medicine. Until we shift that to that position, we're going to continue to look at it as an economic stimulus package that provides economic stability to the country, but not health care.
So what we're doing is that the percentage of money that we spend on health care seems to be growing faster than the other things that our country spends money on.
Well, that's right. And when you do that, the system's just getting worse. Then you get people to get together and say, well, we've got to cut costs, right? We've got to cut costs. And we can cut costs all right, but we're cutting services. We're still spending way too much money because we're getting sick. How could you spend more than twice as much as most countries spend on health care and be ranked last? I mean, there's something wrong with that picture.
It's not working.
And that's what's happening in the U.S. today.
So we want more, and then
more,
we'll be, more of what doesn't work.
Yes, try harder. Cut more costs. We'll add 30 to 50 million new people who are today uninsured in the United States, and we'll put them in the mix. And what do you think is going to happen? We're going to have a system that already sucks, a system of Medicaid where you can't get timely care, you can't get quality of care, the service is not done in a way that's thinking of the individual at all, it's about money. When you have a system that works like that, and you put in 50 million more people, it's inevitable that you're going to have to do what? Cut services.
So you,
there's no other way to balance the budget.
Yeah, so it's going to dilute it all.
It will dilute it down. We'll have everybody covered, but with what? Would you want that kind of health care?
Well, the other problem we have is that we have a major concern for our aging population.
Well, the baby boomers are getting older. We're living longer. We're getting more diseases, okay?
Because so now we're going to get less care?
Well, look what's happened to Medicare now. They're talking about, well, we've got to make some cuts here, maybe up to 2% a year. And over 10 years, that's 20% of your services right there.
Then what about private health care? I mean,
well, that's run by people who what? Want to make money off you. Now you're running a system, okay, with private insurance that has a 25% markup over what Medicare would have.
And that's no public saving.
Well, if you had Medicare, it would be public saving. But as you said, if you have private insurance, the profits have to go someplace. They're going to go to the people who have the program. And as we know, they're not interested in the health care service. We know that. It's not about service. It's about return on investment. That's what corporate businesses are about.
So let's talk about how they want to change the style on which they purchase drugs in bulk and the equipment, but then they want to continue to invest in them.
Well, that's not going to save much. What they're saying is bulk buying saves money. Of course it does. We're already doing that. And we're in an ongoing battle with the pharmaceutical industry to try and cut healthcare costs that way because they're making a fortune on what they do. I mean, look at Big Pharma. Of the Fortune 500 companies, the top 10 are pharmaceutical companies.
They have more return on investment than
the other 490 combined. They're doing fine. The problem is they own our Congress. They control the people in Congress by paying them outright money.
Plus
the
media.
They did that. Just before the election, you know, they spent $500 million. $500 million.
Yeah, so about each congressperson got about $1 million.
There's 535 congresspeople. Divide that by 500 million, and you've got the numbers, close to $1 million a person. And then you wonder why we didn't get universal health care, we didn't get wellness and prevention, we didn't get lifestyle medicine. We reshuffled the chairs on the deck of a sinking Titanic. If you think that's okay, that's what you got. It's not acceptable.
Well, some of the suggestions that Canada was making on ways to raise funds because their universal health care system isn't working, they were talking about increasing taxes and private health insurance and co-payments for services.
Well, I mean, that's another way to try and generate money.
And health care cuts.
Well, see, we don't have health care reform. What we have is reform in the way we pay things. It's about insurance reform. And that's never, ever going to give us what we need to have a system that makes ideal sense. Because what do you want in a health care system? You want people to be healthy, right? You want the cost to be affordable. You want people to be happy and healthy and to be able to live lives that have meaningfulness to their lives.
Well, I suggest that everybody read your book, A Return to Healing.
That's a start.
Because it's certainly covered in there.
That's absolutely a start. And that's what we should be thinking about. And until we go back to a system, or we think of a system like that, we're going to continue to be interested in money, not services. And we're going to be looking at return on investment. We're going to be looking at corporate America as running the United States of America, which it does. The people don't have a voice much anymore because they can't pay Congress, okay, what Big Pharma and the other mega corporations can. And so we have to wake up to that and start making changes and build things from the grassroots. We need to go back to the grassroots that our forefathers did in 1776 and set up a system that's more evolved than we are today. One where we're interested in trying to have health care that's affordable, that's real health care, not sick care.
Coming from the heart instead of the pocket.
Exactly. We make that shift, we're on the right track. And you're not going to see corporate America ever do that unless it makes them more money. So the consciousness of the whole world in this has to shift to wanting to serve rather than to take. And that's the problem we're faced with today.
If you have any questions about your health, the number to call here at Prescriptions for Health is 888-874-4888. That's 874-4888. Clostridium difficile, C. difficile, also known as C. diff, it's the most common cause of hospital-acquired bacterial infections. People get terrible diarrhea and inflammation and of the colon and colitis, and it's also life-threatening. I mean, this is a fatal thing. And
in a lot of cases, it is. Maybe 10-15% of the cases of C. diff, they're fatal.
That's and right. It's an antibiotic-resistant infection, and it seems that there's more virulent strains that are popping up all over the place. 1-2% hospital patients acquire this horrible infection.
Well, and it's totally preventable. I mean, this business about, oh, it's bad luck, or we have to clean up the hospital, is baloney. It is so preventable, it's a joke. And the reason people get this is because we destroy the ecosystem of the gut. When you destroy the ecosystem of the gut with antibiotics, with steroids, chemotherapy, a number of other drugs that affect the microflora of the gut, almost everything we do has an impact on a very, very complex ecosystem that needs to be respected. So unless we strengthen our internal milieu, our internal environment, our immunity, our ability to be able to defend against disease, we're going to be at risk for things like that. So
see,
if
a lot
we
of the
use
people that are in the hospital, though, that's why they're there, because
well,
their immune system's shot.
That's part of it. But then we do what we do to them. We disturb that ecosystem, and we wind up in big trouble. That's the problem. Now, how do you prevent that from happening? Two simple little things would solve 90%. All cases of C. diff. One, give everybody in the hospital who isn't totally got a shot immune system a probiotic, which means feed them those bacteria that are the friendly ones that make up the bulk of the microflora of the gut that do all these wonderful things for us to protect us against disease and have strong immunity. And second, use something called Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a friendly yeast. It's like a candida, but it's one that protects us. And so what it will do is it will crowd out the unfriendly candidas and other microbes by taking up space in that ecosystem, and people just don't get C. diff in that setting. We should be giving antibiotics if we're going to give them intravenous, not orally if we can, because when you take them by mouth, they wipe out the gut. We should be giving prebiotics besides probiotics.
To fertilize.
It's exactly what it is. It's the undigestible fiber that we eat in fruits and vegetables that we can't digest, but is absolutely essential for the friendly microbes that protect our own intestinal tracts. So what we're looking at is simply looking at how does wellness work in the intestinal tract? Instead, what we do is our old trick of saying, kill the bug, fight the process that's going on. Don't do anything proactive. You do proactive things, you don't get sick usually. And if you do get sick anyway, if you use the antibiotics, what are you doing? You're killing all the bugs you possibly can in the gut. You're opening up that whole microflora system to a lot of other kinds of infections from growing because they're resistant to the antibiotics you're using to kill the C. diff or whatever else you're doing.
So it's just like a vicious cycle.
It can be. I know I was maybe 15 years ago when I was doing a lot of work in the hospitals, and I was promoting this concept of using probiotics and using nutrients that would support the gut, things like L-glutamine and ultra-clear sustain and some amino acids that are good for the health of the gut. And everybody was kind of saying, oh, yeah, sure, Len, you're right, but not meaning anything at all by it. But when they had their cases that had been in there for 6 weeks and they were still sick, their intent was, well, Mr. Smart Guy, let's see you fix this one. Well, I'm batting 6 for 6. They all went home within a week because it's that straightforward. And these knuckleheads in gastroenterology that won't look at, well, let's call it like it is,
yeah.
Right? These knuckleheads in gastroenterology who are beginning to see the flavor of what this does still don't get it, that you have to support the immune system of the gut and the gut itself if you want it to be strong. It's not about fighting anything. It's about supporting wellness. We can do that, but we have to shift the way we operate, shift the way we think. It's not like it's so complicated. So our nutritional friends who are learning about these kinds of approaches, who have been doing it, by the way, for 30 years, just 30 years, but we don't let them into the hospital because they're not qualified, so to speak, but they are. In fact, most people don't realize it, but there is a a specialty in medicine that doctors can take that's called a physician nutrition specialist. It's a 1 or 2 year course that's taken after residency in pediatrics, internal medicine, endocrinology, etc.
Well, isn't that a good idea since doctors don't get much more than an hour or two nutrition in medical school?
Well, they don't. That's about it. You're right. In here, they got 2 years of it. So they're learning nutritional medicine, which is way more than what our dietitians know. And I don't want to take anything away from our dietitians. They do a great job of knowing a lot about what to feed people. But they aren't doctors. They aren't people who know nutritional medicine. They know a little of it. But they'd be the first ones to tell you, no, don't put that responsibility on me. I don't know how to do that. However, we do need to start paying attention to nutrition and its importance. Because if you don't feed yourself what you need, or you can't digest and absorb what you take in, you simply will not have those raw materials that you absolutely must have to build strong immunity, to sustain wellness, and to do good preventive care. So it's absolutely vital that nutrition be one of the highest priorities in every area of medicine, and especially in the hospital where people are sick and we're giving them NutraSweet in their Jell-O. Hello.
Well, hospitals are known for not having very healthy diets.
Isn't that bizarre?
And when somebody's really sick, about the healthiest thing they offer them is Ensure.
Which is trash. Well, as you just say, it's got high fructose corn syrup, the exact thing you don't want to be giving people because it doesn't serve our metabolic needs at all. It's a cancer promoter, probably. You have to know that cancer cells depend on sugar to live on. And so what do we feed them? Calories. The kind of calories you feed yourself make a difference. We need healthy fats and protein. We don't need a lot of sugar as our primary fuel.
And I remember the time that you had a patient that was very, very sick, and he was on tube feedings, and they were giving him Ensure, and he was having diarrhea, and the family wanted to know what they could do on their part to help out, and you suggested juicing with vegetable juice because you can put vegetable juice through a tube into the stomach.
Right.
And all the hullabaloo that caused with the nurses and the doctors and the phone calls
that
and everything else.
That was nonsense.
And yet, when somebody's sick in the hospital, nobody prevents guests from coming in and bringing seized candy and things like that to
chocolates.
The patients.
I mean, if you want to poison them, bring them in some things
so
that
here
they
they're
don't
trying,
need.
So here they're trying to object to giving somebody vegetables, basically.
Yeah, say, oh, we can't let them bring it in from home. It might be contaminated.
But actually, we were able to do it. We pulled it off, and the guy's diarrhea went away,
and he
got better and ended up getting out of the hospital.
That was
its own story.
That was a miracle. Well, you're right, Vicki, and those are the kinds of things that we need to go back to. There are certain fundamental things that every doctor should know about that hardly any doctor is taught. See, because there's only one disease. One disease. If your cells are healthy, you cannot be sick. So the cause of every disease is cellular malfunction. If you go back and look at what are the pathways that lead to cellular malfunction, there are only four. There are genetic defects. You got a genetic defect. You got a problem. You can't make a certain protein or whatever it is you need. That's an issue. We know that there are psycho-spiritual factors. What you think makes a big difference in your biochemistry and physiology. Third, look at your cell as a microscopic industrial plant. It needs raw materials to be able to make its products. That's food. You don't put the food in there in the right combinations, the way Mother Nature made it, guess what? You're not going to be able to make product. The only other thing that can make a cell malfunction is if you screw it up. You put something in there it doesn't belong. A microbe of some kind, an environmental toxin, some kind of physical trauma. That is it.
And that's what we're doing to all of our environment. We're polluting everything.
We're polluting it. We're making artificial food. It's not food anymore. They're food products. We have all kinds of psychological stress. PTSD is all over the place. We are making some progress in the genetic side. I want to give us credit for that because eventually we'll have gene therapy that fixes some of those problems we were born with and prevents them from happening. So hooray for that. But it's not a Prozac deficiency or penicillin deficiency or some other kind of pharmaceutical deficiency that's causing our illness. We need to go back and be scientists. You know, let's stand up and be scientists. We claim to be scientists, but if we're going to be scientists, let's do the scientific method. Let's look at the genetic, psycho-spiritual, nutritional, and toxic things that screw up cells because those are the things that make us sick. If we do that, we're going to have bypassed a lot of the problems we create by fighting Mother Nature with our war against cancer, our war against diabetes, our war against obesity, etc., etc. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888 if you'd like to join us on our conversation, or if you have a question about your health, give us a call.
This story, that's a great life lesson that I wanted to share with everybody. It's called A Run in the Rain. There was this little girl, and this is a true story, that she'd been shopping with her mom in Target, and she must have been about 6 years old, and this beautiful red-haired, freckled-faced image of innocence, and it was just pouring rain outside, the kind of rain that gushes over the top of the rain gutter so much in a hurry that the earth has no time to flow down the spout. Well, everybody just stood there under the awning and just inside of the door of Target. And they waited, and some patiently, and others were irritated because nature had messed up their hurried day. Well, this little voice was so sweet as it broke this hypnotic trance of people that they were all caught up in. And she says, "Mom, let's run through the rain." "What? Let's run through the rain." "No, honey, we'll wait till it slows down a bit." Well, this young child waited about another minute, and then she repeated, "Mom, let's run through the rain." "Well, we'll get soaked if we do." "No, we won't, Mom. That's not what you said this morning," the young girl said as she tugged at her mom's arm. "This morning, when did I say that we could run through the rain and not get wet? Don't you remember? When you were talking to Daddy about his cancer, you said, 'If God can get us through this, he can get us through anything.'" Well, the entire crowd just stopped dead silent, and you just couldn't even hear anything but the rain, and everybody stood silently. No one came or left in the next few minutes. So the mom paused, and she thought for a moment about what she would say. Now, some would laugh it off and scold her for being silly, I suppose, but some might even ignore what she said. But this was a moment of affirmation in a young child's life, a time when innocent trust can be nurtured so that it'll bloom into faith. "Honey, you are absolutely right. Let's run through the rain. If God lets us get wet, well, maybe we just needed washing." Then they ran, and everybody stood watching and smiling and laughing as they darted past the cars and, yes, through the puddles, and they held their shopping bags over their heads just in case. Well, they got soaked, but they were followed by a few others who screamed and laughed like children all the way to their cars.
That's crazy.
You know, they ran, they got wet, and everybody, I guess, turned out to need a washing. You know, circumstances or people can take away your material possessions, and they can take away your money, and they can take away your health, but nobody can ever take away your precious memories. So don't forget to make time and take the opportunities to make memories every day. To everything, there's a season and a time, to every purpose under heaven. So take the time to run through the rain.
Vicki, that's just beautiful. That brings a tear to my eye as I think about that. We get so brainwashed, it's probably the right idea, into thinking we have to be adults. We can't have fun. We can't just be in the moment. When I look at a child that's looking at a flower for the first time, maybe at age 3 or 4, they're looking at that with such intensity. They're right there looking at every little thing. And you go, Johnny, it's time for lunch. Johnny doesn't hear a thing. Johnny's looking at the flower. He's experiencing the present. And, of course, that's our gift, and that's what you're talking about. Live your life fully. Enjoy every moment that you can. Don't let your judgment stop you from being who you are. Be playful. Be like a child. This is beautiful stuff. I love that.
The number here at Prescriptions for Health, if you have any questions about your health, is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. You know, the last few weeks, we've talked a lot about herbs and spices in preventing cancer because we keep getting these new studies that are coming out, and even some question regarding using them with chemotherapy. Now, a new study shows that saffron, you know, the mild Indian spice that colors yellow rice,
yeah.
that colors rice yellow,
yeah.
that it actually may prevent liver cancer. Mm-hmm. Yay, something else natural to add to the list of killing cancer cells.
You know, there are so many things that we take for granted, we know nothing about. And we get this arrogant attitude of having to be scientists. We have to do a double-blinded, placebo-controlled, randomized study, or else it doesn't mean anything. And if we don't understand it, we're throwing it out until it comes into a some study that shows it. How much hogwash can you believe? That's not even science. Fact is, we throw out placebo in that, which is nature's healer. We throw out nature in that setting.
Well, we throw out nature when we talk about herbs and spices, too, because, you know, we allow people to be poisoned with chemotherapy, and yet many times people object to people eating healthy food. I mean, we've talked about some of the herbs and foods, like, you know, there's cruciferous vegetables, and I know that I've had people tell me that their doctor has told them when they're in certain regimens not to eat vegetables.
I know, it's unbelievable. Somebody on Coumadin, for example, don't eat those green leafies, they'll screw up your ProTime. What moronic thinking that is.
Or if they're on chemotherapy, they're afraid for them to take vitamins and supplements because that might make the cancer cells healthy, I guess, is the way they think about mm-hmm. it. But do they ever think that maybe they could give the supplements at a different time of the day than the chemotherapy?
Well, did they ever think about making it scientific and doing a study on it? Okay? If you're going to have an opinion, you ought to have something to back it up. Otherwise, stick with Mother Nature and go along with what she says. It's not the double-blinded, randomized, controlled study that gives us the best answers in life. You already know the best answers in life. The example I can give you is with the infrared light therapy that I'm using on so many things in my practice that I find it's unbelievable that it's not the first thing we think of in our treatment for so many conditions that involve pain or inflammation or swelling of some kind. I know it works. I don't need a study to do that. But my colleagues aren't going to believe it for lots of terrible reasons, because they could ask me. They could come and witness it. They could see it themselves. You have to do a scientific study for a diabetic who has neuropathy, who we know we can treat. Do you have to do a study? Or could you come to my office and watch me treat 10 people who have diabetic neuropathy and see the look on their faces when the pain is gone and they can get up and walk and they don't need their crutches or wheelchair? Do you think that might be a good piece of information to look at? Do you think that's valid? And do I even care if it's good science, if I know it's working? Am I so regimented and so much connected to how I look at things that I only think of the regimented way that we do science? It's a shame that things have to be so complicated. And I have to admit, I will do what I have to teach people whatever it is that I know that I think will be of value. And that's why we're doing a National Institutes of Health grant at the University of California in San Francisco on patients who have chemotherapy-induced neuropathies. So I'm forced to do that. The logic behind it makes me sick. The fact that you have to have a placebo-controlled group in the study outrages me. If I take a group of people who have diabetic neuropathy and they get better, do I have to worry about this as a placebo effect or this is some other thing? I could give a damn about that. And my patient will care less.
Well, for one thing, too, there's no downside to it.
Well, what happens if you get better and say, well, it seems to help people. Maybe we should try that. Oh, no, we've got to get placebo effect out of it. Why? The goal is to make people better. And we should do whatever we can that's simple and effective, that's cost-effective, to get the answer. And here we are spending $5 million, $5 million on a study like that. Gets to be insanity. And I'm criticizing my own study.
Well, so the chemotherapy can for cancer can cause the neuropathy many times in people.
Oh, it does. It's common.
Okay, so there are many other side effects of chemotherapy that are pretty unpleasant. Most people are aware of what they are. But I think that this is a good time to review a little bit about some of the natural therapies for chemo, for cancer.
They are so much more powerful than chemotherapy most of the time that it's a joke. You look at breast cancer, colon cancer, okay, two common cancers. You make sure that you're fit. You make sure your vitamin D level is good. Your risk for getting cancer or having it get worse if you have it is going to be way less. You're looking at 50, 75% less. You show me a chemotherapy that will do that. Lifestyle still has the highest ranking for me in terms of that.
Also, to add on to the saffron, you know, this is a plant. It's an antioxidant, it's an anti-inflammatory, and it's anti-cancer. And some of the other things that we've been talking about in the last few weeks that have been coming out in the news that are good for cancer are artemisinin, methyl jasminate, vitamin C, some of the cruciferous vegetables like cauliflower and broccoli and kale and Brussels sprouts and cabbage.
You just said a great mouthful of stuff, Vicki.
So put saffron in your cabinet.
That's
right. Medicine cabinet.
And a lot of other spices and herbs.
In your spice cabinet.
Look, it should be fruits and vegetables, seeds and nuts, herbs and spices. Have a nice day. A great way to run your life. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We'll be back taking your calls, and we have a call. Bob from New Jersey is waiting. We'll take it as soon as we have our station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda with Nurse Vicki. The number, if you have a question about your health, is 888-874-4888. And we're going to start out with a call. We have a call from Bob from New Jersey. Hi, Bob. How you doing?
Good afternoon, Doc.
Good afternoon. How are things?
Things are pretty good, other than this situation that I have that's been ongoing here. And I got a new pair of eyes looking at it. I just heard something that you said that... flashback to me that could be the problem, because it seems to be in my digestive system more so than anything. I'm starting to, well, first off, I'll say I'm in the 50s, and they generally say that at that age, you know, you start losing muscle and so forth and so on. But
yeah,
this started about 6 years or so, and what I see is that I'm losing the muscle, I'm losing digestive, you know, ability, and I'm saying that that's usually not normal. I've seen others that are.
Well, what kind of digestive issues do you have, Bob?
Well, I'm not having BMs, you know.
Are you constipated?
Well, generally. I keep it.
Well, how many bowel movements do you have a
transit
week?
Time.
That would be the good way to start. How many do you have a week, Bob?
Well, at least maybe 3-4.
Okay, so that's not normal, and if you get backed up like that, it produces toxicity in your body because it's like blocking up your sewer system. You block up the sewer system, the pollution goes into the body, and then you wind up not feeling well. And there's so much you could do about that. Do you have any other digestive symptoms besides that, or is that it?
Well, you know, other than cramping in the abdominal area, you know, that's about it.
Do you get bloated as well?
Not so much bloated as much as well, yeah, I guess you could say a little bloated because it feels like especially
you don't have indigestion. So when you eat food, you don't get that burning pain after you eat.
No.
Okay, so the easy thing for you is just a few simple things. You need to have more fruits and vegetables in your diet, probably.
Do you exercise?
Right now, I normally exercise, but right back there in my Achilles heel, I got a little knot or bump that prevents me from, you know, doing the jogging, and I used to do, you know, calisthenics and
well, what about water? Do you drink enough water?
I believe so.
Okay.
And why I say that is because some days I'll drink, you know, a gallon. Other days I'll drink a little less. I don't eat with my... meals because it dilutes the digestive juices.
Let me make this simple for you, Bob. It's really not complicated. There are a few things you can do. A healthy diet is certainly something that's important. And if you're getting plenty of fruits and vegetables and getting the fiber you need, I'd say 30 to 40 grams of fiber a day is what you need. If you're consuming that and you still have a problem, there's something going on in the GI tract that's not right. So when you get constipated like that, you want to do something to help the stool to get softer and to promote more peristalsis. And the best way to do that is to do the following things. If you got a pencil, you can write them down. One is to take a probiotic. We talked about that earlier in the show. Those are the friendly microbes that will keep the right kind of microflora present in the intestinal tract. So I would do that. Second, I would use an amino acid called L-glutamine. And by the way, this is not advice. These are suggestions to discuss with your doctor because I'm not your doctor. So this is not medical advice. This is medical information. So I would use L-glutamine, and what I tell my patients to do is take about a teaspoon, which is about 3 grams of L-glutamine twice a day. And then lastly, you may try something called artichoke extract. It's real cheap. It's got a lot of fiber in it. It'll hold water in the stool and make it softer. If that doesn't work, you need a workup. A real workup. And I don't mean endoscopies and colonoscopies. It may come to that at some point in time, but not at the start. What I would do is called a comprehensive digestive stool analysis. It's done by a lot of laboratories, the Great Smokies Lab, Dr. Data's Lab, and many others will do that test. And if you have a doctor who understands nutrition, they'll get an enormous amount of information from that and guide you as to what you could do to change your diet, change your lifestyle, change things that are related to stress and sleep that might make a huge difference here. So I hope that helps you, Bob, and thanks for calling. You have a good day. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
I'll bet that you never thought that having your blood work done could have a downside. You know, it turns out that drawing blood for medical tests could actually make people sicker. And they, you know, this new study suggests that taking blood for testing over and over might not be as innocent as the doctors used to think. Now, research has shown that half of heart attack patients who arrive at the hospital with normal levels of red blood cells, they go home with anemia, often serious enough to cause symptoms like fatigue and shortness of breath. So how common is this, and should patients question their blood work as to its necessity?
Well, you know, we doctors, we get sort of ingrained in what we do, and we assume that what we do is necessary, and we do everything we can to keep people healthy. And I remember when I was an intern, and I was drawing blood on the ward every morning because that was one of my tasks as an intern. And I would look at all the tests that I had ordered each day on every patient. And, of course, I didn't know what I was doing because I didn't have any experience. So I ordered all the tests I could think of that might be relevant. And by the time I was through, I was taking, you know, a half a cup of blood from some people. Jeez. And if you do that every day for a month, you're going to have what? Anemia. There's no question, because it's like bleeding that much. It's the same thing. So we've got to keep that in mind as something that's a concern. Now, we doctors tend to order a lot of tests because we want to not make a mistake. And I can understand that. I don't want to make a mistake either. And I tend to order my share of lab tests for sure. But I think we need to think twice, particularly when somebody's in the hospital. We don't overdo it, because the last thing you want to do is run the risk of having to give them a transfusion with somebody else's blood.
Well, also, do the lab technicians really need that much blood in a tube?
That's another good question, and that's debatable. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's final 2020 tip.
Well, I have another story for you this morning. This one's called The Wooden Bowl.
Are you going to make me cry again?
I think so.
Oh, dear. I'm getting used to it.
It's a tale to remember with another life lesson. I guarantee that you're going to remember this tale. There was a frail old man, and he went to live with his son and his daughter and their four-year-old and his four-year-old grandson. And the old man's hands trembled, and his eyesight was blurry, and his steps faltered. And the family ate together at the table. But this elderly grandfather's shaky hands and failing eyesight made eating difficult. And the peas would roll off his spoon onto the floor, and when he grasped the glass of milk, it would spill on the tablecloth. And the son and the daughter-in-law became irritated with all this mess. "We have to do something about Father," said the son. "I've had enough of his spilled milk, his noisy eating, and all the food on the floor." So the husband and wife, they set a small table in the corner. And there the grandfather ate alone while the rest of the family enjoyed dinner.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, since grandfather had broken a dish or two, his food was served in a wooden bowl. Now, when the family would glance over in grandfather's direction, sometimes he had a tear in his eye because he was sitting there alone in the corner. Mm-hmm. And still, the only words the couple had for him were sharp admonitions when he dropped a fork or he spilled the food.
Oh, jeez.
Now, the four-year-old was watching all of this in silence. And one evening before supper, the father noticed that his son was playing with wood scraps on the floor. And he asked the child sweetly, "Well, what are you making?" Just as sweetly, the boy responded,
Oh, I'm making a little bowl for you and Mama to eat your food in when I grow up. Well, the 4-year-old smiled and he just went back to work. The word so struck the parents so that they were speechless. Then tears started to stream down both their cheeks. Though no word was spoken, both of them knew what to do. So that evening, the husband took the grandfather's hand and he gently led him back to the family table. And for the remainder of his days, he ate every meal with the family. And for some reason, neither the husband nor the wife seemed to care any longer when a fork was dropped, the milk was spilled, or the tablecloth soiled. Now, on a positive note, I've learned that no matter what happens, how bad it seems today, life goes on and it'll be better tomorrow. And I've learned that you can tell a lot about a person by the way he or she handles 4 things. A rainy day, the elderly, lost luggage, and tangled Christmas tree lights. And I've learned that making a living is not the same thing as making a life.
Indeed.
I've learned that life sometimes gives you a second chance. And I've learned that you shouldn't go through life with a catcher's mitt on both hands. You need to be able to throw something back sometimes. And I've learned that if you pursue happiness, it will elude you. But if you focus on your family and your friends and the needs of others, your work, and doing the very best you can, happiness will find you. And I've learned that whenever I decide something with an open heart, I usually make the right decision. And I've learned that even when I have pains, I don't have to be one. And I've learned that every day you should reach out and touch someone. People love that human touch, you know, holding hands, a warm hug, or just a friendly pat on the back. I've learned that I still have a lot to learn.
Is that so beautiful? Yes, it did bring another tear. Sometimes we forget about what life is about. We get so involved with making money and doing things that we have no time to do the things that we're put on this planet for, which is to be in the moment, to develop healthy relationships, and to love one another.
And I think that story isn't just for the elderly, because sometimes parents treat their children the same way, you know, kind of like children are to be seen and not heard.
Yeah, it's such a shame. It's such a shame. Well, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We have an email question that came in from Phil from Staten Island. He says, when you advise to avoid sugar if you have cancer, does that mean you should cut out fruits since they have natural sugar? Well, you know, there's a difference between high fructose corn syrup and fructose that comes in fruits. And while I don't think sugar in general is a good idea, because we know that cancer cells depend on sugar for their metabolism, because they basically don't have much in the way of healthy mitochondria. And it's the mitochondria that burn fat. And that's what we normally burn in our own systems every day, unless we're doing very hard exercise where we get anaerobic. So it's fat that we want to try and feed ourselves the most and have it be healthy fat. When you eat fructose in the form of fruit, it comes with fiber. So you're eating the poison with the antidote. That makes the sugar, the fructose that's converted into glucose, rise more slowly. It gives the cancer cells less of an opportunity to take it in. So I would say some fruit in small amounts would be acceptable to people who have cancer. But the major thing I'd do is make sure that if I had cancer, that I was consuming a diet that was high in fat, particularly medium-chain triglycerides, which are fats that are found in things like coconut oil, a very, very healthy fat for our brains, our hearts, our muscles. Very bad for cells that are cancerous because they can't metabolize it. So if you basically starve a cancer cell by not giving it much sugar, you'll be doing the best that you can to not nourish it so that it grows as though it has kerosene on a fire. And that's how I look at that, Phil. Good question.
The number here at Prescriptions for Health is 888-874-4888. That's 874-4888. Three out of... really surprised me, this study. 3 out of every 4 U.S. healthcare workers uses some form of complementary or alternative medicine or practice to help stay healthy. In fact, doctors and nurses and their assistants and, you know, health technicians and so forth and healthcare administrators were more likely than the general public to use alternative medicine options. And now this analysis means that even our healthcare workers are recognizing the need for alternative options to
Doesn't
improve
that
our
say
health.
A lot?
Yeah, because it always seems like they're so critical of it.
Right. Well, what you do reflects what you really believe in your heart. And when you see numbers like this, it's kind of mind-boggling, because what it means is that there's been some kind of tipping point where all of a sudden doctors and nurses, which is what we're talking about here, really believed that certain kinds of complementary alternative medicine could be valuable. So they're looking at things like yoga and massage and acupuncture, Pilates. And a lot of what they're doing is they're trying to treat their pain syndromes that way. People who have neck pain, back pain, and joint pain are looking to complementary alternative strategies. Because let's face it, the strategies we use in the mainstream, unless you're talking about a replacement of a joint, aren't safe, don't work that well, and don't solve the problem.
And you know, also 38% of Americans are using some form of complementary alternative medicine, like you said, like, you know, chiropractic and Ayurveda and mm-hmm. Chinese medicine and some of the energy healing treatments and the mind body and biological based therapies.
Well, see, that's right.
So maybe some of the healthcare practitioners, the doctors and the nurses, are learning from their patients.
Well, what they know is what they do in their own field doesn't work well enough for them, so they're looking for an alternative outside the mainstream.
And yet many patients are afraid to admit to their doctors that they are doing alternatives.
Well, that's because a lot of them are very critical. It's an amazing thing in science, and I don't know why I call it science, but in science, which includes medicine, if we don't understand something, we throw it out. We just categorically throw it out. If there's an energy medicine of some kind that's based on biophysics or electromagnetics or light therapies, we just throw it out. We say, oh, I can't do anything because I don't know anything about it. That's like a little kid saying, I'm going to take all my marbles and go home because this isn't working out. I'm not in control anymore. What we should be doing is looking for every single discipline that there is that could add anything to the kind of treatment that we think could add to the care of our patient. That's our moral and ethical responsibility. And when we throw that out, it's wrong. It's not scientific, and it's not helping our patients. So what we're seeing here is a transformation of the way the doctors and the nurses think. They realize that we need new strategies in certain areas. And so they're looking to whatever they can find that's non-invasive. They don't want all the toxic things that can cause problems. They don't want to be on Celebrex or Vioxx or Bextra or a lot of those drugs that are finally taken off the market or should have been taken off the market a long time ago. And they don't want to take the risk of what happens to you. They don't want to wait 50 years for a drug like Darvon to be taken off the market because we didn't know that it caused cardiac rhythm disturbances and premature deaths. It took us 50 years to figure it out. So what they're thinking is, let's use non-invasive strategies that don't create problems so much, that are safe to use, and may have a chance of working. We're always looking for new things. If we're smart, open-minded, and wanting to help our patients, we've got to be looking for new technologies. We should be supporting research. We should be looking for things that we don't know about and studying them.
Instead of being defensive about them.
Exactly. And so why would we just throw something out because we don't understand it? Oh, I can't try that. I mean, what happens if it doesn't work? Or what happens if a patient goes bad on it? Or what happens if there's a malpractice suit because I did something that wasn't approved by the FDA?
You know what some of this is reminding me of? About 35 years ago, and I was still working as a nurse in the hospital, and I was having some cervical disc problems in my neck. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those were the days, and they still are the days, really, where a lot of orthopedists are very critical of chiropractic adjustments.
Yes, indeed.
But anyway, so I was working in the hospital, I was having neck problems. There was an orthopedist that I knew when I was working in the recovery room that was trying to adjust my neck for me. And I don't think he knew anything
about
it.
That was a chiropractic adjustment.
And then there was a neurosurgeon that would do the same thing. He'd say, one time he took me in the chapel so nobody'd see him do it, you know. And the other one did in the recovery room where everybody was recovering from surgery, so there were no witnesses, you know, to what they were doing. But isn't that interesting that they were doing that? And then one of them, I remember when you and I started dating, he was trying to teach you how to adjust my neck.
Yeah, right. Well, see, we take these naive, arrogant positions that Only doctors know what to do.
But what would those doctors know about doing a neck adjustment? Well, a chiropractor has to take a lot of training to learn how to do
that.
Well,
what they should have done was suggest you go to the chiropractor.
Yeah.
They're trying to do what they're trying, what the chiropractor has been trained to do. And now we know that alignment is very important. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, that's grammar school stuff. If your bones aren't aligned in your neck or your spine or your arm or your foot, I mean, obviously, there are going to be problems with mechanical movements. And if you have enough stress put on a joint because of that, you're going to have pain and deterioration of that joint. That's why we have hip replacements and knee replacements and other kinds of replacements. We should be looking at the simple basics. The chiropractors have a ton to offer. And I want to support them because they help me so often with my patients who have back pain.
You know, I had my neck adjusted and it helped my sciatica.
Yeah, well, because the neck and the back, guess what? They're connected, Vicki. And if the neck is off in its alignment, the back will be off in its alignment. And when it is, the weakest part of your body is what's going to show the defect. And that's why you had an L5 disc that was causing radiation of pain down into your leg. That's just straightforward stuff. So we need to open up our minds to be thinking of getting support from people who have other kinds of therapies. And if we can get their support and we can work together, it does what I call integrative medicine. And integrative medicine is a beautiful style of practice.
Where medication and surgery should really be the last resorts, not the complementary alternative medicine, which is often the way it's done. People go to their Western medical doctors and they can't help them, and so then they think, okay, now I'll go to an alternative.
Yeah, or maybe they'll move on to surgery, which is what happens all too often too. I mean, we have enough disease to go around. We don't have enough solutions. We need all the help we can get. Why be arrogant and say we're the only ones who can do the job right when we haven't solved the problem either? I remember back when I was going to Duke Medical School, and they told me, you have to be careful about the other disciplines out there. The chiropractors don't really know very much. They're trying to treat cancer with manipulations, and of course, that was, what did they know about it anyway? The homeopaths were giving things that didn't have anything in them, so there was no pharmacology to it. The Chinese medicine doctors were talking about using acupuncture, which of course couldn't have any neurological basis, but then how would they even know? And so over the years, as I found myself not excelling so much in how I was practicing with my patients, after about 25 years, and that would have been somewhere in the mid-80s, it occurred to me that there is a better way to do things if I just be open-minded. And that's what we're dealing with now. It's a more open-minded kind of approach where we can ask our colleagues, what do you think of this? We can do what's called a healing circle, which we do all the time at the Health Medicine Center. Or we'll meet with a chiropractor and a body worker and a sports medicine doctor and somebody does imagery, somebody does infrared light therapy and Chinese medicine. And we'll look at somebody who has pain. And we'll look at the psycho-spiritual stuff that's behind it. What's the felt sense of the pain? What does it mean? Why do you have it? Is it just unlucky? And it's the most amazing thing when you spend 2 hours with these patients in that setting. And by the way, these are all free, always free. The looks on their faces when they've been listened to and they've been cared for and they feel supported and there's a community of healers of which they are one, it makes a fantastic difference in the outcome of how these people approach their problems. And a lot of the pain that they have gets better. We all know that our pain gets worse when we're depressed and anxious, right? That's when it's the very worst. However, if we can look at some of the post-traumatic stress that we all have, because we all had dysfunctional lives in our childhood, maybe we can look at some of those issues, get past them, because what we didn't have for tools when we were kids, we do have now. And when we do have those tools and we use them, we can solve problems a little kid couldn't. But we don't realize that. So we continue to suffer. Not a very good way to go.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is that Americans spend almost a third as much money out of pocket on herbal supplements and other alternative medicines. In fact, it's estimated at $34 billion a year. Mm-hmm. So the bottom line is that Americans spend a lot of money on complementary alternative medicine.
Well, that's because they're not getting what they want in regular medicine. But they still, when they get sick, they go back to their doctor. That's about fear, but it's also about faith. We doctors do a lot of brilliant things. Our technology is unbelievable. We can do incredible microscopic surgeries that are done by robots. We can do gene therapy. We're talking about stem cell therapy. We're talking about some forms of chemotherapy that can be life-saving that are amazing. We always want to respect the wonderful field of medicine. The problem is a lot of it's out of hand. It's not the first, what I would call, cab off the rank. It's the last one. There's an order in which you use to decide what therapy is right. You always, when you can, start with lifestyle medicine. That's easy. Eat right, sleep right, stress right.
It's not easy for a lot of people.
Well, it's not. It's simple, but it's not easy. That's correct. So we do that first. If that doesn't work, we use non-invasive therapies. Do things that don't invade the body. Maybe acupuncture or homeopathy or body work or some kind of mind-body work.
Meditation. Or
all those kinds of things are great. If that doesn't work, get aggressive. Start using supplements and herbs, right? Get in there and invade that cellular biochemistry and make it different. And if that doesn't work, all right, we use a drug. I'd rather have a drug than nothing. I know there are side effects to it, but I'd rather have an opportunity of getting well if I can, if there's any chance. And if that doesn't work, now you're talking about surgery and invasive technologies. But that is the order that we should be following.
And they
it
all
be
need
medicine
to work together.
First.
It needs to be like a dance.
It is a dance, and it takes people trained in these different fields to be able to collaborate and listen and support one another. We all need to have some kind of participation where we add our piece, but we respect the pieces of the others because it's all important. It's not just one field. If everybody was well and we didn't have the problems we have in healthcare today, fine. Do whatever it is you're doing. I'm all for it. I want to be first in line for it. But if it's not working and we're still all sick as we are and 50% of us have a chronic disease and we can't afford the system that we have and the safety of it is called into question, I want something different. So that's why I'm in this tirade of doing a different kind of medicine. All right. I'd like to remind you that we're back live to talk about what's new in the news in health and to take your health questions every Monday afternoon on Progressive Radio Network. And drsaputo.com from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time and 12 to 1 Pacific Standard Time. They're also archived on drsaputo.com.
And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a wonderful week. We'll see you next week.